Jackson Radio Show.
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
America is under siege. If you listen regularly, you're probably looking at the radio saying something sounds different. Yes, Kevin is out, and I am guest hosting. You may know that Kevin is the executive director of Seeking Educational Excellence. My name is Charles Love, and I am the assistant executive director of Seeking Educational Excellence. I am also the host of the Liberty Hour on AM 560, The Answer in Chicago. You can check me out from 7 to 9 p.m. on Sundays, Central Time, if you get a chance. But like I said, America is under siege. We're being attacked on several fronts, and it is important for people to note and find a way to take action. Kevin and I are a great team because not just the fact that we think alike in many ways, but we truly understand what the problem is and who's causing the problem and what needs to be done. Now, I won't try here to be Kevin's voice because we do take slightly different approaches. And that's what I like, not just between Kevin and myself, but in general, in the conservative movement. You have lots of people out there who take different approaches to pushing back against what's happening today. And while some people say they don't like the approach of others, I think they're all needed and to welcome them all. There's sometimes a rift among conservative speakers and pundits, and they say that this person is right, this person's too right, this person doesn't have the right approach. I think that's not a broad enough view. I think that the problems are huge. We're being attacked on several different fronts, and it'll probably take different approaches to reach different segments of the population. So that's good. So I don't decry what anyone else does. I have my approach, and it may be different from others, and maybe I can reach some people that others can't, and they can reach people I can't. And collectively, we'll get the message out, and that's what's important. So my approach is to give them their argument. It may sound a little odd on the surface, but when you think about it, it makes sense. I am all about freedom and liberty, and I think that people should be able to say what they want, and I love the laboratories of democracy, and think that if people are able to communicate their point and make their argument without being attacked, and without the media and other dark and shady organizations twisting things and putting out misinformation, I think that the left should be able to make their argument. The right should be able to make their arguments. And we have a free expression and exchange of ideas. And the best ideas and the best solutions should win. I also, of course, think that more often than not, those solutions will come from outside of the aisle. So this is why I always say, give them their argument. Because whatever the topic is, you let them say what they want to say. You rebut it and explain why it doesn't make sense. You give them a clear path forward and let people decide. And I honestly, even as dark as things may seem, still believe the average person would understand that what you're saying makes sense. They just need to be able to hear it. So, like I said, I'm sitting in for Kevin. Kevin's out all week. So we're going to get to a lot of important things. We're going to get to things as they break and come up. But I want to use the time to kind of open this up, let it breathe, and kind of slowly and methodically talk about why I say America's under siege, and why the only way we can truly push back, you know, we have people like Kevin, myself, and others who are fighting the fight. But if we really want to win and accelerate the process, we're going to need far more people to get involved. So I talk a lot about how everybody can get involved, because everybody doesn't have a radio show And everybody can't do what Kevin does. I was going to say Kevin's unique, but we're all unique. But Kevin has a unique voice and approach. His is full of hard-hitting humor and right in your face. Others are more, you know, cerebral and slow, you know, methodical and things of that nature. All these things are welcome. You may be different, but there's still things you can do and people you can talk to and ways you can get the message out. And I'll talk about that some too. But America being attacked on several fronts, the economy, its founding within the government, the private sector being attacked, healthcare, race relations, and of course, education being the approach that we at Seeking Educational Excellence tend to use to highlight some of these problems and try to find solutions. And the attacks are coming from within. So what do you do? We have a small but loud, but also growing percentage of Americans who simply don't like America. And that's why that is so scary. If we just had people that loved America and they disagreed with us and they thought that there were different avenues and better ways to solve the problem, we'll be fine. But that's not what the case is. Now, some of them were cloaking their views in, we love America, we just want to, you know, tweak some things. But now they're open about their disdain for America. So if that's the case, you have to wonder, why aren't more Americans standing up against that? You think the average person, even a liberal, would look at this and say, hey, I don't agree with the right, but what these people are saying about my beloved country is wrong, and we need to stand up and take it back and do something about this and stop this before it gets out of hand. But they're not. Now, why do you think that is? Here you have Americans living in the greatest country that's ever existed. They have an opposition party that they want to beat. They want to get their power back. You can understand why they make some moves to have that, to accomplish that goal. But they're doing things that are detrimental to the fabric of the country. And if you want to beat them, and if you listen to the Kevin Jackson Show every day, I know you do, one of the key things in finding a solution is understanding the problem. And part of that is the why. Understanding why they're working.
Is the Kevin Jackson Radio Show. This is the Kevin Jackson Radio Show.
And it didn't cost us a dime.
Kevin Jackson Show. KevinJacksonShow.com. Charles Love sitting in. I am the author of We Want Equality and the Assistant Executive Director of Seeking Educational Excellence. Follow me on Twitter at CDouglasLove3. CDouglasLove3. So I mentioned my book, We Want Equality, because I want to tie in the point of what I write about and most of what I talk about. I generally take a macro approach to the issues going on and just use the news of the day to supplement my argument. I have been for years talking about how the culture is shifting to the left and hurting the fabric of the country. And we're going to lose what we know to be America if we don't push back against it. And the hard part is those who are causing the problems control the means of information. So we have to be creative and hypervigilant in how we push back. They have Hollywood, they have the media, they have the news, they have many corporations. There's really not an angle they haven't gotten. So you kind of have to look at how they got here. I talk about solving problems, and part of the biggest part in the first step is understanding what the problem is and how you got there. So in that vein, I talk often about how this has been a process that's been happening, and it's been years in the making. And too few of us speak out or act against it. And then of those who do, too many of us, which is understandable because it's the thing that's in our face, spend too much time focused on whoever is causing the problems today and attacking that person. So we're not really attacking how we got here and what the cause is. This has been a slow, deliberate fall. There are people who don't like the way the country works, don't believe in its founding, and want to see its demise. And they are citizens. And that's a problem. So give them credit. They were smart about the way they went after this. They tried other ways, the direct way. It didn't really work. So they were cunning in their move. One example I give that's not causing it a problem, but just a way I like to paint a picture so people understand it. I used to watch Seinfeld when it was on, and my mom would say, "I don't watch Seinfeld. There's no black people on the show." And I said, "I'm watching it because I think it's funny. It's an interesting show," or whatever. It has nothing to do with that. I don't look at shows to decide if they're interesting based on the race of the people in them. But in the context of what she was talking about, I looked at it and thought, well, technically what Seinfeld did was brilliant, because I noticed there were other characters in the movie, in the show, I'm sorry. But the show was about 30-something Jewish guy in Manhattan. What were the chances that everybody in his circle were going to be black or Hispanic or whatever the case may be? So New York is the melting pot. So they wove characters into the of diversity into the show in real ways. They didn't force him to have a black best friend, which is ironic because Jerry Seinfeld does. But they, you know, you go down to the store and the guy working there is black because there were black people in the store. Or you go to the 7-Eleven, a guy there's Middle Eastern, whatever the case may be. They made it natural. And it was cool. It was no big deal. It was a smart thing to do, and you move on. Some brilliantly evil person got the idea that that is the way to push our narrative into the ethos. So you break it into two groups. So you have some that are doing it deliberately, in your face. We want this. We demand this. And you have some that just subtly put it in. So you look at Hollywood. I started to notice, I don't know, 15 years ago, that, you know, if gay marriage was the topic and the treatment of LGBT community was the topic, what they did in Hollywood, instead of just making movies about, you know, that topic directly, you started to subtly put it in into shows. So you're watching Law and Order. If you've ever seen the show, most people have. It's been on over 20 years. And at the beginning, they have the people doing their natural thing. And then, you know, they come upon a crime scene, find a body, and then that's when they call in and the show goes on. So I remember this one time distinctly. I'm watching Law and Order, and this guy's walking through the park, walking his dog, and, you know, the dog starts to pull him. And he goes over to the bushes, and there's a body there, and he turns to say, "Honey, come here." And when honey came, honey was another man. See, brilliant. What they were doing was normalizing the behavior. So don't throw it in your face and just go from, I don't, taking a segment of the population who doesn't think that gay marriage is okay, and then slapping a gay love scene on TV. Of course, they're going to be like, you know, taken aback. So no, you just normalize. Like, yeah, it's just the regular people in the park. They're just regular people just like you, right? So they did that with everything, and it was little seeds here, little seeds there, and the things start to slowly move. So I talk about in my book now how I don't watch much TV, but I watch it for kind of, you know, social commentary because it's so interesting to me. I watch network TV, mostly cop shows and political shows and things of that nature. And I look at these shows and I thought it was interesting that all of a sudden I looked up and every person in the show, in leadership anyway, was some minority. And that has to be by design. It can't be a mistake. So what they're doing is trying to, again, change the mentality of the average person through Hollywood. They do the same thing in business with their commercials. You know, they're trying to get you to have a certain belief based on what you see. Now that they got the foundation solid and that's worked, now they can just go after, you know, industries and cultures and the norm. And now the movies are in your face and every show has a gay character. Transgenderism is here. Illegal immigration is, you know, either the topic of every episode or somebody in the show is illegal. So you normalize that stuff. And now you get in a situation where people are emboldened to speak out against stuff. I saw an article recently where they're illegal immigrants are kind of afraid and uncertain because of Trump's attempt to not count them as part of the census. This would have just been a normal thing 5 or 10 years ago. They'd be like, no, I don't think these people should be deported, but why are we counting them in, to determine how we split up representation? That just doesn't make sense, right? It would have just been a normal thing. Now mainstream magazines and news articles are writing about how that's so unfair. You have obviously the constant marches for 50 some odd days. And listen closely, whether you agree with them or not, whether you think police brutality is a problem or racism is a problem, you should be noticing the fact that these people have no demands. And if you hear them and you listen to the way they talk, what they're really saying in essence is that blacks should be focused on blacks and whites should be focused on blacks. Everybody should be focused on blacks. And what they want, they don't want equality. They want justifiable inequality. As I said before, they want to right wrongs. And this country is just simply not built that way. Morality doesn't say that that's the way things should be addressed and that this is not good for the country. Back in a moment.
This is the Kevin Jackson Radio Show.
Has to end here.
Actually, it's just gotten started.
No!
This is the Kevin Jackson Radio Show.
I want to talk about crime for a moment. In one specific case, you're listening to the Kevin Jackson Show, thekevinjacksonshow.com. As you know, you've been watching the news and following what's going on. You know, crime has been the topic everywhere. It's gotten a little crazy in most cities. And I'm kind of in a unique position because before COVID was all the rage, my family and I moved from Chicago to New York. I try not to say that too often because I don't want New Yorkers to blame me for bringing the crime from Chicago with me. But it's a problem. And since COVID and the protests and radicals and anarchists and things of that nature are making this happen, I want to talk about Chicago because Chicago is a unique situation. These things are happening now everywhere, so everybody's kind of up. But if we just go back to before COVID, go back to 2019, there was still crime everywhere, but violent crime was down. It had been trending down for 3 to 4 years. It was also trending down in Chicago, yet the number was still higher in Chicago than it was everywhere else. So what was unique about Chicago? I mean, most big cities have this supposed wealth gap. They have gangs. They have race issues. They have everything, you know, they all have these things in common. So what was different about Chicago? And since Kevin has a national platform, I want to make sure I know I'm not only speaking to Chicagoans. So I want you all to let this sink in to get a perspective. Chicago, roughly 2.5 million people, and New York is 8.5, LA 5.5. So you're talking about a little bit more, but let's call it rounded at 5. So LA and New York have 5 times the population as Chicago, but year after year, they have half the murders. So what's different? I mean, policing may be a part of it, but they keep recycling police chiefs from every other city, Philly and Dallas and LA, and they just keep bringing people in. The problem keeps happening. Human nature is flawed, but it's flawed everywhere. That's consistent. The two biggest things that would probably jump out at you is gangs. Not that LA, New York, and other places don't have gangs, but they don't tend to have as large a number of gangs as Chicago. It's like Chicago's gangs when I was younger. I was in Indiana, but you know, we're right across the border in Gary, and it was kind of similar there. You had those, some small ones, but primarily 3 big gangs. Now, what you see is a block-by-block gang. So you got smaller groups, more of them, fewer leaders, and people just kind of going across the board. It's like the Wild West. So that kind of makes it worse. And they say that problem is a little worse in Chicago than it is in L.A. and New York. But an even bigger problem is segregation. It seems so odd saying that in 2020, but segregation. But not in the sense that most people are used to hearing. It's not your 1950s segregation. One, because most of it is self-segregation. People living where they want to live, and they prefer to live amongst other blacks, Hispanics, or white, which, as someone who promotes freedom, thinks is totally fine. Live wherever you want to live. The reason it's a problem is because when you throw crime in the mix and this violent crime starts to happen, and as it unfolds, we find that it primarily happens in black neighborhoods on the south and west side of Chicago. It allows people in other neighborhoods to say, that's bad that that's happening, but I feel separated from it. I'm a Chicagoan, they're Chicagoans, but it's happening in their Chicago and not my Chicago. Because that's the case, the people are less likely to get involved. And we all know if you are disenfranchised, if you're poor, if you're working class, you work two jobs and you got a lot going on and you're dealing with the crime, you are less likely to go to the CAPS meeting. You know, you're not wealthy enough to be a donor, so you can't just call up your alderman and say, you know, I gave $20,000 to your campaign. You need to do something about this. Because that's the problem. Chicago, their last police chief famously said that after one violent weekend, he said, well, we got the crime segregated to one area, you know, and anybody else said it, you look at that and see that just proves it's a systemic racism, but he's a black man. But I digress. So about a week ago, Chicago made national news again because they had a mass shooting. By the way, it's not called that when black people do it, at a funeral home. 15 people got shot. It made the news. No one really talked about what happened afterwards. And I think it's important to note that people do care about their communities. And when you get fed up, you act. And a group of 20 or so people from the community came out to that funeral home the next day, and they had a press conference. I want you to hear what they had to say.
No doubt calling elected officials out, saying they're not doing enough to help neighborhoods be safe. This rally that this group put on today was attended by parents and kids and residents pushing back about the violence as well as trying to unify the neighborhood.
They gather hoping to make a difference as they try to stop the cycle of violence in black and brown neighborhoods.
We have entirely too much representation at every level of government for our communities to have suffered the neglect that they've suffered.
Tanisha Peoples with the Black Community Collaborative has lived on Chicago's South Side all of her life, and like so many, was stunned by Tuesday night's mass shooting that happened on 79th Street, just steps away from where the group held their rally this afternoon.
We believe that in order to stop the violence in our community, everything has to come together. It's not silos. It's not education here. It's not economics there. It's not crime there. It's not everybody is to be held accountable.
Wow. Kudos to them. And we need more of that. You see, people in their community standing up. And if you listen to what Natasha had to say, she said, everything needs to be on the table. It's about solutions. And we don't get that enough. You know, many of the people who complain often complain about things that aren't really the problem. But when they do, they don't offer solutions. They make demands sometimes. But these demands have nothing to do with the problem or the causes, and it's not going to solve the problem. When was the last time you heard them talk about what the causes of the problems are and truly give thought to put into action ways to rectify those situations? No, you hear too much from the squeaky wheels about race and systemic racism and inequalities. Now, the systemic racism is simply untrue and can be proven. But race having an effect is true in some cases. Inequality is definitely true. But that's just surface thinking. That's what I call these people, surface thinkers, because they don't go deep. If you really want to solve the problem and not just be mad and make noise, you say, okay, there's a disparity. Why? Because you may assume it's race, but when you start to pull the layers apart and look into it, you find out it's simply not race. It's income, it's education, it's this or that. And then you attack that. you know, a lot of these roles come back to education, which is, you know, what we talk about so often at Seeking Educational Excellence. You look at the disparities, a lot of it starts in school, like we're talking Chicago specifically here. So over 75% of public school students are Black and Hispanic. Now, if the schools were performing, it wouldn't matter because Black and Hispanic kids can learn just like anyone else. But you talk about the racial disparities and you talk about what white kids are getting, they're not even a factor because they're barely in the schools to begin with. And most of them are either a few poor whites on the one end or successful and wealthy whites whose kids are going to the elite schools that just happen to also be public schools. So if you were looking at that, then you would say, how do we get the Black and Hispanic kids' success rate in school up to par with the white kids and up to par with the private kids, school kids? Because they're no different. They can learn just as well. So it must be something in either the way we're teaching them, the discipline that we are imposing, the curriculum. You know, maybe we're wasting our time in foolish reminders of slavery and not focusing on robotics and coding, whatever the case may be. Then we're talking about solutions, but that is not what people do. So until they're prepared to do that, we will continue to be stuck in a vicious cycle of perpetual violence and despair. We can get out of it. The solution's easy. Executing it is the hard part. So I just think it was important to hear because people think the people in the community either don't care, are not responsible enough, or don't try to push back. But these people were honest enough to say that their representation has failed them. At one point, when they said there's too many people, we have too many people in position, they meant too many Black people. If you look at the mayor, the Cook County Board president, the police chief, the CTU president, across the board, 20-some-odd aldermen, Black people are in power in Chicago and have been for years, and they've got nothing for it. The problem has been that we were voting Black, not solutions. So we think if the Democrats care about us, or we think that if we had somebody that looked like us, we'll get what we need, as opposed to say, this is what is needed in the community. Who's going to give it to us? It may not always be the Black person that can do that. So kudos to them, and I hope that people stand up and take notice and they're able to get...
This is the Kevin Jackson Radio Show. This is the Kevin Jackson Radio Show.
Con Kevino Jacksones.
So Tom Cotton stepped in it the other day. Or did he? You're listening to the Kevin Jackson Show. This is Charles Love sitting in. Tom Cotton, Republican senator from Arkansas, who recently proposed a fantastic bill, the Saving American History Act of 2020. And it was in the media, going back and forth. He got praised. He got beat up. And in an interview with his local paper, made a comment that got more press than the proposal itself. And what the left did what they usually do, and they created their fancy little straw man that they keep handy, and they put on him what they thought he meant, and then they attacked it. And it's a brilliant move, of course, of theirs, and they're really good at it because it's hard for people to come out, because I'm a logical, honest, straightforward kind of person. So I can't come out and with, you know, definitive force say he didn't mean it that way because it's his words. I let him defend himself. But I am, again, logical. So I do say, let's assume, give you your argument. I told you that was my method. So if you want to say that he meant to say what you took it to mean, I ask one simple question. Why omit some important words that changes the context of the statement? And they do it often. If you haven't heard, he was talking about slavery and the way I caught it in the New York Times and BuzzFeed and all over the place was Senator Cotton says slavery was a necessary evil, in quotes. And I was like, uh-oh, he stepped in it. I saw that. That's kind of crazy. Why would he say that? That's weird. But then, come on. Something's telling me that's not the whole story. And I read another headline and another headline. So finally, I just said they referenced the paper that he made the comment
from in the interview, and I went and found and read what he said. And he said, and I quote, as the founding fathers stated, slavery was a necessary evil. And it was in the context of the 1619 Project and not teaching context, saying, leave slavery in. I'm not asking you not to teach slavery, just teach it in the right way or whatever is what he's saying. And so they took that to say he was saying slavery was a necessary evil, or at the very least, he was agreeing with them. So I give him the argument. Maybe he was. I don't know. I can't get in his head and say he wasn't. I doubt it, but let's say he was. If that's the case, why did nearly every headline remove the, as the founder said, and just say, Cotton said slavery was a necessary evil? Only USA Today, of the mainstream papers I read, said that he said the founder said. But that's what they do. But I don't want to spend my time on whether Tom Cotton thinks slavery was a necessary evil or not. I want to spend my time on the proposal, which is good, saying that he wants to take federal funds from schools that teach the 1619 Project. I'm sure the numbers are going to be much higher, but when they first rolled this out, four or five schools jumped on board right away, Buffalo, a couple others, Chicago being one of the bigger cities. But we think after the nonstop demands of the mob, there's going to be a lot more cities. And I think it's dangerous, and it's our kids are already being indoctrinated and led astray and taught misinformation. This is only going to make it worse. So the 1619 Project, if you don't know much about it, is a project to talk about, in their minds, America's founding, and to once and for all put to bed you people who argue against this factual statement that America was founded specifically for slavery. It was built up on the backs of slaves, and all of its positive achievements and everything else to do to slave. And slavery permeates everything through this day for the black man, and there's no way to get around it. So for a very, very tiny piece of the project, I get, because I talk about education obviously all the time, and I talk about history. Love it. And I say all of it needs to be taught, and it needs to be taught in context. But so when they argue that that's not what's happening, I kind of agree. Stick with me. I kind of agree with them. Only because I grew up in Gary, Indiana. All black town, all black students. Most of the teachers were black. So we got a little bit more than the average person. So my experience is a little different. But I talked to my friends around my same age who lived in different neighborhoods than my white friends. And their knowledge of the history of blacks in America is very limited. And I think that's bad for America, and it's bad for them. But not in the way that people think. I think that, you know, waiting to February, saying it's Black History Month, and doing another piece on MLK doesn't really teach anyone anything, because most people know about MLK. And that is not the end. And the MLK and slavery is not the whole existence of the Black experience in America. I actually don't want Black history taught. You know, I got attacked once for a Facebook post I made after the NFL said their foolishness about playing the Black national anthem or whatever. And I said, wow, hearing all these people respond, it wasn't that I didn't agree with them, but they kind of took it out of context. I said I was just shocked. No, I said hearing so many people not know that the song existed makes me more believing the fact that we need a better education. It helped me understand that more people, we needed more conversations and more people needed to learn more. They thought I was saying, yay, alternative song at the football games. What I'm saying is we're not getting enough history now. So that's the one, you know, millionth of a percent that I agree with the 1619 Project on. But what the 1619 Project purports to do is to give you the true history. What they actually do is just give you a far more skewed version of history the other way, right? So they want to teach you history's bad, history's permeating everything, capitalism in America is slavery. That's the only thing it is. That's what it's based on. That's the only way it works. So capitalism is bad. Everything they say is complete madness and factually inaccurate. And it didn't matter that many historians, several of them not conservative, called them out on their inaccuracies. New York Times still stood behind them Oprah is still making a whole series of movies about it. Your kids are about to be indoctrinated. So what the point of my Facebook post was, you need to know the history. So when your kid comes home and thinks that they know the truth and they don't, that you can correct them. Because I can tell you today, those teachers, although they're warped, they're good. Those social justice warriors. So they're going to tell the kids what you're going to say. So when you just say, no, America's great, or you just say, I'm the parent, listen to me, they're going to say, ha ha, I knew that. Right. So my challenge with 1619 and my challenge to you to learn more is to be armed and prepared for these people, because they're going to stick the roots in deep. And early I said, I don't want Black history taught. I don't. I think history should be taught this way. There's world history, and each year, each semester, you learn a different area. And then there's American history, and you do it by year. So you do, you know, early North America, just the Americas, and then the founding of the country, and then this section, and you move in time. And when you're in that time section, if you're teaching 1875 to 1905, then you teach whatever happened in there, good, bad, ugly, Black, white, Chinese, whatever. You don't have to have Black history, because that way you learn about Black history as it flows in a natural way all the way through, and Chinese history and immigrants and everything. You're learning everything, and that's what you need to do. This 1619 project says that the founders were racist, but anybody can Google the fact that some of the founders didn't own slaves. The 1619 project says the country was founded in 1619. Well, everybody knows that was Britain, but and everybody says 1776, but we had a war first, so you had to push it up a couple years. The 1619 project says that slavery was permeated the whole country, but they don't say that at the height of slavery, 20 states didn't have slaves at all. They even say, here's a new one from that I heard. They say that the Revolutionary War, not the Civil War, the Revolutionary War was fought to say to stop because Britain was going to abolish slavery. They don't tell you when Great Britain abolished slavery, which was many years later. This is toxic and dangerous. And then to the founders being racist and slavery, slave owners and loving slavery and thinking it's a necessary evil, they're going to teach the negative part, which is totally fine with because it happened. But they're not going to teach you what George Washington and John Adams and Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson said about slavery, which is not a positive thing. They did not say good things about slavery. Washington, there's not a man living who wishes more sincerely than I do to see a plan adopted for the abolition of it being slavery. John Adams, every measure of prudence, therefore, ought to be assumed for the eventual total extirpation of slavery from the United States. I have, through my whole life, held the practice of slavery in abhorrence. So I'm open to full education. That's fair game. But teach it all. Teach the ugly and teach the good. And the most dangerous part I'll leave you with is that the founder of the 1619 Project said in response to Tom Cotton that I never said 1619 Project was a work of history. It is of memory. Well, if it's not history, why are we teaching it in our schools?
This is the Kevin Jackson Radio Show.